A good old-fashioned power grab today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Xi Jinping is the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao Zedong, and now Xi wants to do away with term limits on his own stay in power.
This is the latest accolade that he's accrued to himself here. And yes, I think it's, as everyone sees, a real consolidation of power that we simply haven't seen since Mao's time.
Of course, Chinese social media users are pushing back, and then there's the pushback to the pushback.
Online censors, which have always been quite active in China, are now really going into hyperdrive.
Also, a group in Pakistan decides there needs to be a better way to properly dispose of old or damaged Qurans.
That's why they came up with this idea of putting them in these tunnels dug deep into a mountain.
That and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could make it here today. America first. President Trump has made it pretty clear where his focus is, but it's left some people wondering whether that policy cedes too much American authority to other countries. Germany, we hear, is the new leader in Europe, maybe the world. Russia is also vying for the globe's attention, with mixed results. And then there's China, nearly 1.5 billion people and growing, and a political system that doesn't show many signs of opening up. Add to that the news that term limits for China's leaders are now over. It was Communist Party Chairman Deng Xiaoping who introduced the two-term limit in 1982. The aim was to prevent the rise of leaders for life. Now, 36 years later, President Xi Jinping plans to change China's constitution to scrap term limits entirely. So as China steps into this void left by Trump, what kind of role model is Xi Jinping proving to be? Kaiser Kuo is the co-host of the weekly Seneca podcast, which is all about current affairs in China. He joins us from New York. What does getting rid of the two-term limit actually mean for the Communist Party?
Well, I think these norms that were put in place during Deng Xiaoping's time, the age limits for one thing, the idea that you couldn't stay on the Politburo Standing Committee if you were over the age of 68. Also, the idea that you don't go after either sitting or former Politburo Standing Committee members, that politics was no longer going to be a blood sport. You don't go after their families. You don't put them in prison. And of course, this whole two-term limit idea, these were all characteristics of the Chinese Communist Party that I think many people, I would certainly count myself among them, believe that, you know, whatever you think of the Chinese Communist Party, these norms were good for its resilience, for its durability. The party is, you know, definitely dictatorial, but this meant maybe that it wasn't as dictatorial, that it was maybe authoritarianism light. This move, though, appears to be, you know, tearing up the norms, and I think will diminish the view of the Communist Party in a lot of the rest of the world and among many Chinese people. There's no question that we've seen this steady accumulation of titles of honorifics. Xi Jinping thought, that's an abbreviation for a really clunky name for the whole thing, has actually been enshrined as part of the party constitution. So this is just the latest accolade that he's accrued to himself here. And yes, I think it's, as everyone sees, a real consolidation of power that we simply haven't seen since Mao's time.
What do you think it means, though, for Xi's policies in China?
There's a school of thought that says, you know, what Xi is trying to do right now is secure his position so that he can enact reforms that will take a longer time. That's a pretty optimistic gloss and one that I, you know, would hope to see true, but I don't think that's really the case. I think that there are people who would say that this is evidence that he has really successfully consolidated power, that he's very secure and stable in power. Again, I don't really see it that way. It's hard for me not to see that. Usually when a leader expands or extends authority in an already authoritarian country, it isn't indicative of security or stability. It's indicative of a systemic problem, and I think that's probably the case here.
There are some people who think term limits from the get-go are undemocratic because they remove free choice. We are talking China, though, so it's not as if we're talking real free and fair elections. But have you heard anybody saying this is actually a good thing for China?
Yeah, I've heard people say that it's a good thing for China, but these are people who have already made up their mind about Xi. You know, really think of him as that, you know, sage king, as the philosopher, or whatever. I don't think that most people who are open-minded about this see this as an unequivocally good thing at all. I think that it's fair to say, though, that viewed from Beijing, the whole process of democratic elections looks just horrifically wasteful, just really inefficient. I mean, we squander here in the U.S., of course, so much time and energy, and we get so vexed over, you know, our political differences. And just all those countless hours in the Chinese way of thinking might be better spent constructively on planning, on laying out infrastructure, on addressing actual needs of people. And that's, you know, that's the argument that I think that we're seeing mustered from that side. And you've already seen state media take the opportunity to lash out at the failings of democracies.
How do you think this is going to affect China internationally, like its reputation?
I mean, I think before 2016, something like this would have been much worse. But of course, you know, because of everything that's happened, this sort of global shift toward authoritarianism, this doesn't stick out quite as much as it might otherwise have. There's no question to me that it's going to exacerbate this whole China threat idea. It's going to really, I think, magnify the differences in our values and our institutions between the liberal democracies of the West and China. So it's going to be bad. But again, I think that will be mitigated by the fact that we are struggling with our own problems with right-wing parties, with authoritarian-style leaders rising in Turkey, for example, with Erdogan, and elsewhere in the world, in Eastern Europe and what have you.
I know it can be hard to gauge because of censorship on social media, but how are people in China reacting to this move on Weibo and Twitter? I've heard that this meme comparing Xi Jinping to Winnie the Pooh is making the rounds. Maybe you can explain that meme and what that says about the whole situation.
Yeah, I've seen that a bit. That meme originated with the Sunnylands Summit, I think, which was back in 2013, if I'm remembering correctly. There was a summit where Xi was photographed walking with Barack Obama. And Xi, even though he's tall, is not nearly as tall as Obama, and he's rather portly. And so the meme was passed around showing Winnie the Pooh walking next to Tigger, and Tigger was Obama, and suddenly Xi Jinping became Winnie the Pooh. I know that that particular image and other images of Winnie the Pooh are actually censored in China. So now, after these constitutional changes were announced on Sunday, immediately, people started sending images of Winnie the Pooh sort of hugging a gigantic vat of honey, for example, with him dressed as a king and sort of celebrating his coronation. And yeah, I mean, this is testimony to the wit and the humor of a lot of Chinese internet users.
Kaiser Kuo there. He's the co-host of the Seneca podcast.
The censors are working overtime ever since it was revealed that the Communist Party wants to remove term limits.
And that's my BBC colleague Celia Hatton. She's staying across whom and what China censors are going after online. And as it turns out, Winnie the Pooh isn't their only target.
Online censors, which have always been quite active in China, are now really going into hyperdrive, removing terms, references to so-called Emperor Xi, removing quite critical comments posted online saying, you know, things like, if our grandchildren ask us, what were you doing back then? What would we tell them? Do we stay silent?
Government censors have been moving quickly to help keep President Xi's critics silent on the web. On the Chinese social media platform Weibo, they're said to be taking aim at phrases like, I don't agree, I oppose, long live the emperor, and even the date, 1984, which was presumably being used to reference George Orwell's dystopian novel. Here's my BBC colleague Celia Hatton again.
It is interesting to see that even very sort of basic comments noting this change are being censored from the internet. And I think really that shows that President Xi Jinping still has weak parts. He has really eradicated a lot of his opposition. But of course, there are many people who still are unhappy with his rule. And so he doesn't want to give them a chance to unite online. And that's why the censors are so busy right now.
And if President Xi gets his way, those censors will stay busy for a while. The Quran, of course, is Islam's central religious text. For many Muslims, the writings are literally the word of God, and that means any copy of the Quran should be treated with respect. Even if it's damaged or stained or unreadable, it should never be thrown in the trash. But if you have an old, damaged Quran, what do you do with it? In Pakistan, one group of people has found a solution and created a system to respectfully dispose of disused Qurans: sacred burials in tunnels in the side of a mountain. My BBC colleague Sikandar Kermani went to investigate.
According to most Islamic scholars, there are a number of respectful ways of disposing of Quranic texts or copies of the Quran. One of them is to put it in flowing water. Another one is for it to be buried underground. Another one is for it to be burnt. In Pakistan, burning copies of the Quran actually has quite negative connotations. People have been lynched because they think it's a sign of disrespecting the Quran. When I was speaking to the guys who founded this project, they were saying that really the reason they came up with it is because they felt that there wasn't another established way of dealing with this issue in Pakistan. And so that's why they came up with this idea of putting them in these tunnels dug deep into a mountain just on the outskirts of the western city of Quetta.
Yeah, so who are these men who are doing this?
So it's just a kind of a group of private individuals. It's the person who kind of set it up was he's no longer alive. He passed away. His brother's now running it. But he told me that his elder brother, basically from when he was a young man, had a kind of passion for the Quran, and he used to go around, according to his brother, picking up kind of Quranic texts that had been that were lying in gutters, and initially he'd just put them in the boot of his car and keep them safe. Then they tried burying them in a field somewhere, but they felt that wasn't properly respectful enough, and so they had this some land on the outskirts of the city, and they decided to use it to create this kind of complex, basically.
Yeah, so you visited this facility. I mean, it's kind of, as you say, it's kind of like a cave complex. Give us a sense of the scale of the place and where it is in Pakistan.
Yeah, so this is on the outskirts of the city of Quetta, which is kind of in the west of the country, right close to the border with Afghanistan, actually. Mm. And there's a big mountain, and they basically dug, around a dozen or so, I'd say, tunnels through the mountain. I think in total they were saying there's about 2 miles or 4 kilometers worth of tunnels that they've dug already. And in most of them, they've got these sacks of kind of bright colored fabric. Each sack contains about 8 to 10 copies of old or damaged Qurans. And these tunnels are just filled to the brim with these sacks. So they estimate that there's millions of Qurans in there. They don't know exactly how many, and it's really impressive because you're kind of walking deep within the mountain, and kind of each tunnel has a separate couple of other tunnels shooting off on each side of it, and most of them are just completely blocked in by these bright colored sacks filled with these Qurans, and some of the sacks have kind of small prayers scrawled on the side of them as well. And just outside the tunnels, there's this huge pile of material that they're waiting to go through, because each day they get a kind of minivan or so of new copies of old Quran sent to them. One man, his name's Maulvi Abdul Quddus, it's his job to basically sift through the material and work out what to do with it.
Some books, like this one, are only a little damaged, so we repair them and give them away. But when pages are torn like these, we bury them in the tunnels.
And Pakistan has some very strict blasphemy laws, and people can actually be accused of blasphemy for mistreating the Quran. Is it fear of those laws, do you think, that this project has gotten some legs?
It's hard to say. I mean, I would have thought most of the people who are doing it are not doing it out of fear, but are doing it out of a sense of religious obligation and duty. But it certainly has a kind of dual purpose in that it allows people a safe and established way to dispose of these copies of the Quran that could potentially otherwise be problematic for them.
My BBC colleague Sikandar Kermani speaking with us from Islamabad about the men who provide a final resting place for Pakistan's Qurans. Sikandar, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Just ahead on the show, two Syrians paint drastically different pictures of their lives in their war-torn country. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. We're going to spend the next few minutes looking at what's been going on in Syria over the past 9 days. If you've been following the headlines, one part of Syria, a suburb of Damascus, is going through some of the worst fighting since the war began some 7 years ago. Eastern Ghouta is one of the last strongholds of Syria's anti-government rebels, and right now it's being described as hell on earth. Syrian and Russian warplanes targeting rebels and extremists have been dropping bombs relentlessly on Eastern Ghouta. The UN has been trying to negotiate a ceasefire, and Russia has asked for a five-hour pause in the fighting to give civilians a window to evacuate. Dr. Mohammed Khatoub is a doctor with the Syrian American Medical Society and has been involved in humanitarian efforts in Eastern Ghouta. The BBC reached him in Turkey and asked him about the truce.
We don't believe that this truce will bring any benefits for the civilians inside Eastern Ghouta. 5 hours is not enough to do anything. Even this truce doesn't mean that we NGOs work there will have any access to bring any items inside Eastern Ghouta.
Meantime, in Eastern Ghouta, hundreds of civilians have been killed. Media activist Noor Adam is there.
Actually, I don't know when I am going to die. 1 minute I am alive, the next minute I don't know if the warplanes target my office or my shelter or my building. Today, more than 15 airstrike hit the towns in Ghouta and killed 5 people, between them 1 woman and 3 children. Most of the building destroyed. The Russian warplanes and the Assad government target most of the town in Ghouta right now. The government of Russia, they are mass murderers. And right now, above our head, there are warplanes.
We heard about this humanitarian corridor that was meant to let civilians leave Ghouta. Russian officials, though, say that rebels shelled this corridor. Have you seen the corridor?
That is not true, actually. Just the propaganda. No one want to leave Ghouta because they know the Assad government and Russia will arrest him and beat him to death.
But nor the civilians staying in Ghouta. I mean, isn't that almost certain death?
Yes, but that's our home. How we can leave? How we can forgive Assad or Putin? They killed our friend. They killed our family. They killed our children. How we can forgive that regime forces or Russian government? You can hear right now the world bans.
So you're saying the people in Ghouta don't trust anybody in the international community or really anybody in Syria right now?
We don't trust anybody. We see the Security Council voided for a ceasefire, but we don't trust anybody.
The UN has promised aid deliveries and medical evacuations. Did any of that happen?
No. The United Nations, until today, did not enter the Ghouta. We have a shortage of medical supplies. We have a lack of medicine. Their family, like from 4 days until today, they don't eat anything. Because the wood is very expensive, the shop is closing, the streets are empty, people are hiding from the bombing in the shelter, but the warplanes and the bombing target the shelter and they target every building, every shelter, and every hospital.
Are you seeing any rebel fighters in the street?
Rebel fighters are in the front because actually the people here love them because we believe him, they will protect us from Assad government and Russia and the Iran military.
There's also a very strong chance that the presence of rebel fighters in Ghouta is precisely why Ghouta is getting hit by so many bombs.
No, actually, we love them and we believe them because they want to help in us and protect us from the Assad murderer. They are not terrorists.
Noor, is there any situation that would force you to leave Ghouta?
No, actually, I don't want to leave. And all the people here, they don't leave because that's our home and that's our right to live here. And we will never leave. We want to live in peace and we want to go to school. We want to see our future. But the Russian government, Putin, he's mass murderer and he killed our future.
Noor Adam and Ghouta, thank you very much. Stay safe.
Thank you.
About a 30-minute drive from Eastern Ghouta is Western Damascus, and that's where we contacted Namat. We've had her on the show before, and as in the past, we're only using her first name.
We can hear that shelling, the noise that comes when they are firing. We can hear the fighting jets flying in the sky on top of us. This is something that you cannot miss, actually, in Damascus, especially during last week. In the last week, the armed groups were showering Damascus with dozens of these mortar shells and rockets every day. People got scared. It feels more like 2012, 2013 again. If they don't have something urgent, they are not going out of their houses. I'm one of those people. When I was hearing about all of these mortar shells and rockets that been fired at Damascus City, I decided to restrict my movements. Actually, even schools, the schools were closed. In last Wednesday and last Thursday, the schools were closed. Many people who are having exams at the universities, they decided not to go. So and right now, I can hear the shelling now.
You hear that? Yeah. So how do you actually understand what's happening in Eastern Ghouta?
There are many armed groups in Eastern Ghouta, and there have been infights between these armed groups themselves. There is al-Nusra and there is ISIS also. They are having some kind of alliance with other Al-Qaeda terrorist groups who are located in this area. So they have these kind of infights over power, over money, due to the differences between their sponsors.
And at the same time, the government of Bashar al-Assad and the Russians, we read, are bombing Ghouta.
Of course, they are fighting against the Syrian government.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it's people who are paying a really terrible price for all this. We just spoke with a civilian in Eastern Ghouta, Noor Adam, who describes himself as a media activist. And he's been posting heartbreaking, really heartbreaking photos online of kids and the elderly who've been pulled from the rubble of aerial bombardments. Many of them had been hiding in basements. Have you seen those photos?
Of course, we've been these photos, but I don't know if you have also seen the photos of people who were killed and injured due to the armed group's shelling on Damascus City, where we have 7 million people living in Damascus City.
Yeah, but there are hundreds of people being killed in Ghouta, aren't there?
Oh, of course, there are people who are being killed, but we don't know whether these stories are true or not. We do not know exactly whether these statistics are true or not. Even the photos, definitely there are thousands and hundreds of photos that are not really true, and they did not happen now, or maybe happened long time ago, or in other areas, or maybe fabricated.
Well, it's clear a lot of the facts on both sides are being disputed. At one point in our interview, Noor said, "How can we forgive Assad or Putin? They killed our friends, they killed our family, they killed our children." What would you say to him in response?
Well, we can say the same thing. How can we forget those people who have killed our families, killed our friends? I feel for those in Ghouta because I have also loved ones, friends whom we have lost during this war. We all, each and every house in Syria lost somebody, whether a friend or a loved one or a family member. I lost one of my friends. And she was young. She was at the university when the mortar shell fell on the Faculty of Science.
How do you reconcile that? Do you forgive?
What can we do? What can we do if we don't forgive? This war is going to go on forever. It's going to kill somebody else's loved one, somebody else's friend, somebody else's family member. We should understand each other. We should feel the same thing. At the end of the day, we have to forgive because this is the only solution. Other than that, an eye for an eye, the whole world will become blind.
Namat, a resident of Damascus, thanks for being with us again.
You are most welcome.
I'm Marco Werman. This mom has a small child who just happens to share a name with someone on Canada's no-fly list, and that makes it real hard for them to travel.
I need this to be fixed. This isn't something that somebody should have to deal with for their entire life.
Walls you don't see, just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Washington Post is reporting that President Trump plans to visit the border with Mexico next month to take a look at the prototypes on display there of different kinds of 30-foot barriers. At The World, we're looking at barriers this week as we launch a series of stories called Walls We Don't See. Monica Campbell, The World's Global Nation editor, is with me now to talk about the walls we don't see. What is the idea behind the series, Monica?
Well, Marco, when you think about immigration and walls, what comes to mind?
Well, first and foremost, I see the border wall that Donald Trump wants to build and also a lot of fence that's already there that you and I saw a couple of years ago.
Right, that fence that went into the ocean that splits California and Mexico.
Right.
that it's so iconic. I mean, when we think about walls and immigration, we think about these concrete barriers and these tall fences, and that's a big deal. But we also know there are nearly 200 types of visas for getting into the U.S., just one example. Each one of those visas presents its own complicated obstacle, its set of policies. We also have programs that let immigrants already in the United States stay here if it's too dangerous to go home. All of these visas and these programs, they have their own walls. Along with that, we have other walls we don't see. No-fly lists, you know, these kind of black hole blacklists that people can get on. And also financial walls that people can hit when they're trying to come into the United States to live. And so we've called this series The Walls We Don't See.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to look at these other obstacles. So you mentioned a few examples there. What about one story that has especially moved you?
I mean, one story that was reported by Ashley Cleek out of Florida, it focuses on this family from Honduras. And this mom, she came to the U.S. years ago. You know, she paid $4,000 to come to the United States from Honduras. She was smuggled up. And now she hit a challenge when her kids in Honduras faced increasing violence there, and she wanted to bring them to the United States. Well, it was no longer $4,000 to come to the U.S. It's now $8,000, the smuggler told her, each.
So I've seen a number of these stories already at PRI.org. That's where we can all see them. Some are interactive, actually. They actually guide the viewer through a fictional scenario in which you can think about what you would do if you were trying to get into or stay in the U.S. and up against some pretty big obstacles. And I'm looking at one scenario right now. It begins with, make your way through the complex maze of seeking asylum in the U.S. Can you navigate the U.S. immigration system? And Monica, I went through it and really just spend 2 minutes with this interactive feature and you'll start to get a picture of the life-changing and gut-wrenching choices that so many people have to make on the spot, often without the advantage of speaking English. Anyway, in this scenario, we'll walk through the story of a young woman in Nicaragua who's abused by her husband and she heads up to the desert and then all these series of choices she makes to deal with the situation.
Right. And so this is a fictional story, but it's based on real world examples. And the idea is that you can kind of walk through this person's world as they hit these kind of forks in the road when it comes to, you know, I'm at the U.S.-Mexico border. Do I cross over illegally? Do I ask for asylum? What happens when I ask for asylum? And we know these are really complicated cases, but the idea is to try and put yourself in that position, in those shoes, and walk with these people. And we'll see, you know, just how complicated those scenarios can get.
Well, like I said, it's pretty immersive. I mean, some of the stories that we're going to hear are also quite vivid and, frankly, pretty intimate. I know that one coming up this week is about H-1B visas because I interviewed somebody about it already. I think that's set to air on Thursday. What's coming up today, Monica?
So today we have this incredible piece by The World, Shirin Jafari, about a three-year-old whose name matches another name on Canada's no-fly list. So these kind of black hole blacklists that people can get on that can prevent them from traveling. And we'll hear that story next.
Another wall we don't see. Monica Campbell, thanks for setting up the series.
You're welcome, Marco.
And here's Shirin's story.
It can shake.
In many ways, Sebastian Khan is just like any other three-year-old.
No, it needs to wiggle.
He loves playing with his toys and is curious about everything. But when he was just a few weeks old, his mom, Heather Harder, noticed something bizarre.
When we take a trip on an airplane, we book our tickets like everybody else. And then when it's time to check in online, we're not able to.
At first, she didn't think much of it. Maybe that made a mistake. But it happened again and again. Harder and her husband, Zamir Khan, say it took 5 more airport visits to find out what's going on.
A sympathetic ticket agent said, you know what, actually I have to call in for additional security. He's been flagged from this list. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me.
The list Harder refers to is the no-fly list. It's what countries use to block potential terrorists from boarding a plane. Every time you book a ticket in Canada and in many other countries, airlines run your name against a list like this. If your name matches one on the no-fly list or is close to one of them, then you have to go through additional screening. But when babies get flagged as security risks, people like Harder say the system is flawed.
He had just learned to walk maybe 2 months before, so very much still toddling in a toddler sense.
2 years ago, Harder and other families in Canada formed a group called the No Fly List Kids.
What we've been taking issue with is that, you know, children as young as 6 months old are being screened, which is ridiculous.
Khaled El-Ghazar is a lawyer for the group.
This system flips the presumption of innocence on its head. People are sort of presumed to be a risk without having had any opportunity or any notice, or any ability to oppose that.
So 2 years on, why hasn't the Canadian government been able to fix this? Ralph Goodell is Canada's public safety minister.
But to be clear, there are no...
In November, he told Parliament that it would take three things to change how the no-fly list works in Canada.
That takes new legislation to fix that problem, new regulations, and a new computer system.
New legislation, because right now, airline protocol doesn't allow staff to tell passengers that their name matches someone on the no-fly list. New regulation, because currently there is no appeal system. Goodell said his proposed bill addresses all of this, but it hasn't passed yet. Meanwhile, Hina Shamsi of the American Civil Liberties Union says no-fly lists don't just stay in the hands of one government.
We know that the United States shares information about its master terrorism watch list with multiple other countries, including Canada. We also know that President Obama and Prime Minister Trudeau committed to sharing additional information about each country's no-fly list.
So she says anyone on the Canadian no-fly list would not be able to come to the U.S. or even fly over U.S. airspace. That's what happened to Aisha Vahidi's son, Sahel, several times.
Can I get you a cup of tea or anything?
I met them at their home in Toronto. Sahel's been flagged at airports since he was in a stroller.
Whenever we go through immigration, my child's looking at me and apologizing, and I hate that. Like, he feels bad because he thinks he's done something wrong. He's done nothing wrong except be named something, which is actually something we did to him.
That room's kind of a big mess, but...
It's okay.
Sahel, who's 17, says being singled out at airports has impacted his plans in life.
No, this one was my first jersey.
Like, he had to give up American football, which he enjoyed a lot.
I guess the older, like, the higher divisions you go into, there's more games, like, in the States a lot, especially, right? Maybe, like, New York or, like, Florida.
That would mean long extra screening time at airports. It was just too much.
Instead of going to the higher division, I stayed in the lower division. Then I stopped football.
Sahel stopped playing football, but his father, Dawood Khan, worries how all this could impact his son's life beyond airports and ticket counters.
Today, you know, we call this a no-fly list. You know, tomorrow, this no-fly list, this data could end up, God knows in whose hands, and it could become a no-job list, no-credit list, you name it.
It's what Heather Harder and Zamir Khan, Sebastian's parents, think about, too.
I need this to be fixed by the time Sebastian turns 18, by the time that he, you know, may require to go elsewhere. This isn't something that somebody should have to deal with for their entire life.
And as for Sebastian, he doesn't know about any of this. He's just a kid. A three-year-old who happens to love flying.
What's your favorite part when we go on an airplane ride?
When we're going through a cloud, I'm like, where am I?
For the world, Shirin Jafari, London, Ontario.
You can read more stories of those affected by the no-fly list and check out the rest of our Walls We Don't See series at PRI.org. So the Winter Games are over, and there's another week before the Paralympics start in South Korea. So yeah, we get it if you're going through a little sports withdrawal. You're in luck, though. We've got this story for you about a champion athlete. When he competes, though, there's usually no one else in the race. From just outside Paris, here's Rebecca Rossman with his story.
I'm inside the Velodrome National for the Coupe d'Hiver cycling finals outside of Paris. About 120 cyclists are competing in different races. But the big draw is this. Robert Marchand turned 106 in November. Today he's doing a 4,000-meter solo race, about 16 laps. He's also wearing his signature purple and yellow cycling suit and pink helmet.
comme d'habitude.
This is hardly Marchand's first rodeo. He set multiple cycling world records since his 100th birthday in 2011, making him the world's oldest competitive cyclist. Last year, he set a new world record in the 105-year-old and up category, a category created just for him, after he cycled 14 miles in an hour. In January, French media reported that Marchand was retiring from cycling per the advice of his doctors. That turned out to be wrong.
Parce que même si les médecins lui ont interdit de faire du vélo, de battre des records.
Jean-Michel Richefort with the French Cycling Association says even though Marchand's doctor told him he shouldn't race anymore, he said, "I'm the one who decides, and I want to ride a bike." Marchand was born in northern France in November 1911. That's about 6 months before the Titanic set sail, and nearly 3 years before the start of World War I. He hopped on a bike for the first time when he was 3 years old. But when he was 22, Marchand's coach discouraged him from cycling professionally.
I was told I was too small and that I would never be a champion.
He's about 5 foot tall and 115 pounds. So he tried gymnastics and boxing, where his wiry frame would be an asset.
I did pyramids. I was the smallest, so I was always at the top.
After becoming a gymnast and boxer, Marchand held dozens of different jobs over the years. In Paris, he was a firefighter. In Venezuela, he worked as a truck driver and sugarcane planter in the 1940s. Then he went to Canada, where he chopped wood as a lumberjack. After he'd had enough of the Canadian winters, he came back to France in the late 60s and settled in the northeast Paris suburb of Mitry-Mory, where he still lives today.
Ça c'est Paris, vous voyez?
Marchand shows me around his modest studio apartment, which includes a single bed, trophies and ribbons along the walls. Then there's one of Marchand's most prized possessions, his exercise bike.
Voilà. Alors, tous les jours au matin, 10 minutes, sans pousser, comme ça.
Every day, I do 10 to 12 minutes of physical exercise.
When he was just shy of his 100th birthday, Marchand confided in his friend Gérard Missler about a crazy idea he had.
Il m'a confié à 99 ans qu'il voulait établir un record du monde des plus.
He said he wanted to establish a world record category of 100 years and over for one-hour track cycling.
So Missler, a cyclist himself, made some calls and became Marchand's coach. In 2012, Marchand set a world record by cycling 15 miles in an hour at the age of 100.
Ben, je dis moi, je fais pas ça pour épater le monde. Je fais ça parce que c'est pour prouver.
I don't do this to be a world champion. I do it to prove that if you follow a healthy lifestyle, you can still do a number of things, even when you are old.
That healthy lifestyle includes eating lots of fruit and vegetables and very little meat. He doesn't smoke and only drinks the occasional glass of wine. Marchand says his cycling adventures are a chance to relive his youth. But one of his happiest moments happened in 2017, when he set his last world record.
J'ai passé un moment magnifique. C'est le jour que j'ai battu le record, que je suis devenu champion du monde, là.
I had a magnificent moment the day I became champion du monde. To be on top of the podium in front of all these people singing the French national anthem, it was a moment of incredible emotion.
Un moment d'émotion formidable. Voilà.
Marchand says, contrary to what's been reported, he plans to keep pedaling for as long as he can stretch his legs. For the World, Rebecca Rossman, Paris.
We're going to end the show today with a really great detective story. This one takes us back to the days of the British Empire and an event known to many historians as the Indian Uprising. By the mid-1850s, the British had conquered the Indian subcontinent using an army composed mostly of Indians. Then in 1857, many of the soldiers had enough and rebelled. The British crushed that outbreak of violence, and the only way to describe it is brutal, a brutality that has been largely whitewashed in British history. And when the story of the uprising is told, it's almost always from the British point of view. A new book, though, tells the story from the other side. It's called The Skull of Alam Beg. Kim Wagner is the Danish historian who wrote it. My colleague Rupa Shenoy recently got to ask him about the mystery of the skull and the remarkable clue that helped solve it.
Let's start with the skull. Who was Alim Beg, and why do you have his skull?
Alim Beg was, in many ways, an insignificant soldier, just one amongst thousands who served in the East India Company army, but who got entangled in the uprising of 1857. And in 2014, I received an email from a family who had a skull, and they didn't know really what to do with it. And so I, they'd found my name by accident online, and so I went to look at it. And so the story was that the skull had been found in a pub in 1963. The new pub owners had found it, and inside the skull there was a brief note which gave the name of the individual to whom it belonged, namely Alim Beg. But it also described the Scottish and British missionaries that he had allegedly murdered during the outbreak in 1857. And then finally the fact that he had been executed by the British by being blown from a cannon, after which his head had been collected and turned into a skull and taken back to Britain by a British officer.
So you're handed this skull. How do you go find out who this is in your hands?
Well, I mean, it comes with a quite a big responsibility to be handling somebody else's mortal remains, and especially so because of the circumstances. Alim Beg, he never imagined that, you know, his remnants would still be in existence more than 150 years after these events. And the interesting thing for me as a historian was that without the note, which is about 150 words, without the note giving me just a few tidbits of information, really, his name, his regiments, the name of the officer who took his skull, I wouldn't have been able to reconstruct anything, really. So the skull in and of itself does not tell a story, but the skull with the note offered a kind of historical puzzle, if you wanted. And that's what I found really interesting in trying to reveal and flesh out, pardon the pun, a deeper history behind the skull.
But DNA backed it up?
DNA tests are quite expensive, but I did have people at the Natural History Museum in London look at it, and they confirmed the date, the gender, and also rough ethnic background. So there's nothing about the skull that didn't support the story of the note.
So what did you discover? Why was he executed?
The British, they took a brutal revenge as they were suppressing the outbreak in 1857. This was arguably the biggest anti-colonial uprising anywhere in the world. And since the rebels, the Indian rebels, which consisted of both former troops in British service, but also civilians, peasants, dispossessed rulers, they would attack those small garrisons consisting of a few hundreds, you know, British people scattered all over northern India. And in many instances, women and children, British women and children, were killed. And for the British, this was really a traumatic experience, but also something that really caused outrage. So when the British, they managed to suppress the uprising, they would have these exemplary displays of ritualized violence. And one of the most iconic methods was tying Indian troops to guns and blowing them to pieces in front of other Indian regiments, but also in front of local Indian villagers who were forced to watch this grisly spectacle.
Cannons, right?
Yeah. There's no cannon ball inside. It's a blank charge of powder, but the blast itself blows the body to pieces. A technique of execution, which is very specifically designed to prevent final rites for both Hindus and Muslims, since it effectively prevents the conventional burial ceremonies. So there's a very specific cultural aspect to that kind of punishment.
Can you take us to the events of the revolt? Like, what was he supposed to have done?
At Sialkot, where Alim Beg was, it wasn't as violent as was the case elsewhere. But there was a Scottish missionary couple and a small baby who were waylaid and cut down. And that is one of the murders that Alim Beg was alleged to have carried out. As I found out in the process of researching for the book, Alim Beg was actually innocent. But as far as the British were concerned, that didn't matter much because all Indian soldiers, and in many instances, all, you know, Indian men in areas where the outbreak had happened, were considered to be guilty, with or without any evidence, really.
So what's going to happen to the skull?
Well, my main aim with writing the book was to tell the world about the existence of Alan Beck, because nobody knows about him, but also ultimately to have him repatriated to India. It would be my main aim. But that's a rather lengthy and complicated bureaucratic process. But that is what I would like to see. I'd like for Alan Beck to finally be put to rest in a respectful manner after he's been kept in various boxes and attics for more than a century.
There are some people who still say that that the British did a lot of great things for India. Are you getting any pushback from people who say that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of debate in Britain at the moment about the legacies of the empire and how we should remember it. And my take is that you really cannot reduce the past to a simplistic binary of either good or bad. So although my book describes in great detail a lot of horrific violence, at no point do I suggest that the British Empire in India was bad, nor that it was good. So what I would like for people to take away from a book like mine would be that it makes it difficult to be too proud of the empire when you remember these things. But ultimately, a more nuanced appreciation of the complexities of the past is what I, as a historian, is mostly interested in.
That was Danish historian Kim Wagner speaking with my colleague Rupa Shenoy. What an incredible story. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.